Traveling the Vortex.
We've joined the Doctor as he travels the Vortex and arrive at episode 586, where everything is a beach eventually. I'm Keith.
I'm Sean.
I'm Glenn.
You guys find your beach yet? Beachfront property here in Kansas.
Someday.
Life's a beach.
Probably someday sooner than we expect.
Sooner than it probably should be.
Right. This week we got another episode in, this time penned by Stephen Moffat, the episode titled Boom.
Caught in the middle of a devastating war on Kastarian 3, the Doctor is trapped when he steps on a landmine. Can he save himself and Ruby, plus the entire planet, without moving?
I was just going to say, boom, boom, boom!
That also works.
Yeah, I like that one.
What's that song? Boom, 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 boom. It displeases me greatly to say that the Beatles episode is no longer the best episode of the season. I'll start there. But the Beatles episode is no longer the best episode of the season.
Well, go, Sean. Start talking.
I may not stop. Wow, what an episode. Right from the get-go, I was excited to see the Anglican Marines back. And I thought, oh, I think I know who that is with the little collar and the camo mm-hmm. pattern and whatnot. And then, nasty war-torn. And what was the name of the planet? Kastarian?
Kastarian.
Kastarian. I kind of thought I heard Kasturberon, which, of course, sent me spiraling into another, oh, is the planet of the Time Lords? What are we doing? Which obviously they were not, it was not in any way, shape or form related to Gallifrey, but I totally went there for a moment. But, I don't know, what a great concept. So what if we take the Doctor and really just immobilize him for an entire episode? I mean, he always uses his brain to get out of things, but what if we really immobilized him and, yeah, it worked. It worked so well.
It's a great demonstration of Nshuti's acting prowess, and he can do so much without barely moving a muscle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as if we couldn't love Ruby more, the whole "I'm going to hand this to you instead of throwing it at you," which that was a terrible plan, Doctor. Of all the plans you've come up with, yeah, toss it to me. No, I don't think that's a good idea. And again, kind of cementing their relationship with the whole exchange between, you're very brave, and if this works, I'm going to be very cross with you for a long time. But that was great. The idea of the ambulances doing their diagnostics and determining, oh, nope, it's not cost effective.
Mm-hmm.
That's terrifying.
Such a statement on capitalism. Of course, mm-hmm. Moffat's done that before with, what was the one on the space station where, Deep Breath, where they were, they pump in the air and then they suck it all out and then they charge you to give it back to you.
Oh, oxygen. Yeah.
Oxygen. Yeah.
Oh, was that what it's called? Yeah, oxygen.
Yeah. Right. And it's not just, not just capitalism. It's also a commentary on war profiteering.
Well, yeah.
Both combined together, which is, although I think a little bit more interesting.
I did think the company Villain Guard was a little on the nose. Although it's Ian instead of A-N, but still a little on the nose.
Although apparently that's been referenced before in Empty Child Doctor Dances, Villain Guard was referenced.
Yeah. I heard them say.
I didn't remember that.
I didn't either. I heard him say on the Doctor Who podcast.
Yeah. Although I don't see it in the TARDIS wiki.
Hmm.
You would think it would reference that in the notes in the continuity.
I'll give it time. What have I been saying this whole show?
Oh, there it
Not
is.
Yet.
Jack Harkness mentions it.
Oh, that's where the weapons factory is on Villengard.
Mm.
And then he later found the planet in ruins in Twice Upon a Time.
Yeah. This is kind of like Moffat's greatest hits then, really. What else have I name dropped? Let's use that.
Okay. Well, anything missing for this episode was Angels.
Yeah, really. Because he even gets a Fish Fingers and Custards reference in. And the way he wrote Ruby felt very much like kind of a mix between Amy Pond and Clara. I felt it didn't quite feel as much like Ruby, but there was enough Rubiness to her that I was okay with it.
See, I didn't think that's what I was worried about Moffat writing for the character, as I was afraid that it would become less Ruby than it was, than we have established. I felt like it was still right in line with her character. So I was actually very pleased because, I mean, she is very determined that, you know, she's not going to leave him behind, which is very Clara / Amy. But on the flip side, I still think she's got the more wherewithal that Ruby seems to have, that, especially for as young as Ruby is, that I don't think the other girls had as much of that. And I think that it still maintains that. And maybe that's, you know, Millie bringing that, carrying that through in the character that she's already been portraying.
Yeah, I kind of interpreted it more as through the acting than the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it felt a bit more like Clara than Amy.
Mm.
See, I think the only thing that I could take away from that was, you know, maybe it's because we got a great bit with her early, that the fact that she winds up sidelined for the last bit of it, you know, wasn't a big deal. But I don't know that I got a Clara vibe other than the next of kin reference when the ambulance kind of freaked out and didn't know who her next of kin was.
Well, yeah.
Because we don't know this yet. But that felt more Clara-ish in that she's a plot point versus a person.
Well, that's not a fault of this story either, because that she's been that's one of the things that I've been a little prickly about with this season with Ruby, is the fact that it feels like another mystery woman, you know, another mystery companion. And I understand the concept of that and why sometimes that's important. And it's almost an easy cheat to have something that will carry you through a season or a series is doing something like that. So I've always sort of, but I don't think that was a fault of this episode, because that's been there since Church on Ruby Road.
Mel came up with a very interesting theory that might explain her background. And I have to admit, I kind of went, oh, you guys will have to decide if you want to discuss that now or later or off mic or what.
No, I think any speculation's on the table.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, specifically in regards to the snow, the fact that, you know, it continually snows around Ruby. And when was the last time that was important? And I said, well, the snowmen. And she goes, uh-huh. And they were trying to, you know, get a body when they were pulling the governess out of the lake and the ice woman and all that. I was like, well, yeah. She goes, what if they finally succeeded and, you know, the great intelligence created a physical manifestation of itself in Ruby, and that's why it's always snowing? And I went, oh, that's a bit of a stretch, but okay, I can kind of see that. And then the episode ends with that single snowflake flying toward the camera, and I'm like, oh, now it's a conspiracy theory, and I'm on board with it.
An interesting idea.
Yeah.
Somebody call Andy. I really enjoyed the multiple layering of kind of higher social commentary that was going on, because obviously there was the war profiteering and capitalism at work, but there was also the, you know, kind of faith issues and thoughts and prayers being thrown around like they are today. And you know, kind of the military industrial complex. And it seems like Moffat just took jabs at everything and put it all together. And with such a hodgepodge of stew, I don't know that it should have worked, but it did. It all came together and really kind of gave this wonderful background tapestry of things. It's like, yes, this is all part of the problem, you know?
Well, and he kind of pokes at it, but at the same time, you know, the daughter at the end, when she's talking about, you know, he's with me, it kind of, you take away that, yeah, they have faith and that's okay still. Mm-hmm. So he kind of tries to walk both lines.
Well, and even the doctor's comment about, you know, I may not like it, but that doesn't mean I don't need it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And, you know, because there's a great many things that you have to take on faith. I think what the doctor takes on faith may not be the same as what the Anglican Marines take on faith, but it is there. So,
yeah.
If there's a weak link on this, it's probably the daughter.
Splice,
thank you. Couldn't think of her name. I don't know why I couldn't think of Splice. But, you know, going through the range of where's Daddy? I heard him talking and seeing the hologram and then lunging for him like she was going to give him a hug. And it's like, okay, it's obviously a hologram and you're obviously from a technologically sufficient society that a hologram shouldn't be that foreign of a concept for you. So why are you desperate to touch it, despite everybody saying no?
And she seemed old enough to really know the difference as well, especially considering who knows how long she's been on this war-torn planet where they're fighting themselves. But
followed by when it gets reactivated and is doing this, you know, here's images of the trip we took to the zoo. And she just kind of sits down in the middle of this bomb crater and it's like, ooh, tell me a story. And it felt very, what? And
it felt like she should have realized what was going on a lot quicker.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if it was just they needed a way to sideline her as well. You know, be quiet and let the adults talk for a minute. Mm-hmm. Or what. But it just, that part felt very disingenuous to me.
I think it was Moffat felt it was a necessity to ratchet up the tension a bit.
I don't know. Those little green lights were doing a pretty good job of stretching up the tension.
Well, they were, but I think when you pile things on top of it, like Ruby being so defiant and that, you know, that she's going to stay with him and the little girl lunging at the, you know, not realizing the gravity of the situation. And I just, Mavity. That on top of the green lights just made it even more intense.
Did anybody get the impression when the initial guy stepped on the mine and it went off that it was cloaked?
It was cloaked when the doctor stepped
on it. It was cloaked. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I thought, because that added kind of to the terror factor of, oh, mm-hmm. man, cloaked mines.
You know, you would never know.
Then he kept yelling at her, watch where you step. And I'm like, well, what good is that?
Well, he didn't know it was cloaked because he wasn't looking down.
That's true.
And he never did look down. And that's why he had to ask her to describe the mine. He was running to help somebody.
Yes.
That's the doctor's weakness.
I appreciated the visual fake out as well of, I think it's an ambulance and this blue flashing light off in the distance in the fog. And we're all going, oh, I know what that is. No, you don't. That's bait. You don't know what that is. Was anybody a little taken aback at the potential boyfriend, Castor? Was that his name?
Carson.
Boy, I'm just batting 1,000 with these names tonight.
Oh, is that the one that Mundy liked and he liked her, but they never said it until like at the end, until it was too late.
Yeah, when he got zapped.
Cliche.
And she's like, are you okay? And I heard his voice and through the filter and I was like, like I audibly gasped. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the room looked at me like, what? It's Doctor Who. So people are going to die.
Amazing that two people lived.
Yeah.
Well,
it was a war, you know.
I think if anything bothered me about this episode, and it's okay, but I didn't really quite understand the necessity for the love story there. And I'm not sure that it needed to be there to make an impact on the events and how they were coming about and why it had to happen and why was that something there so that Mundy had more motivation to believe him that they were actually fighting themselves. Maybe that's why that was there, but I just kind of felt like it was unnecessary that we had this like romance or this flirty, I like you, you like me, subplot that I didn't think was necessary for the story, but that was the only thing that bothered me about it.
Yeah. It kind of felt like it was a subplot to try to ratchet up the tension and to pull at the heartstrings mm-hmm. when you didn't really need it, in my opinion, because you had the father and son or father and daughter aspect of it.
Yeah. And I agree. I kind of think it was almost one too many.
What's really interesting is the fact that Virata Sethu shows up so early as Mundy, but apparently is playing a different character down the road.
Oh, is that
right? When she comes back.
Okay.
When she comes back in season two.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay.
She's going to be the second companion.
Right.
At her and I thought, oh man, that she looks so much looks like.
Well,
her.
I just had it in my head that this was the story she was in, but I had completely forgot that. Yeah, she's the companion for coming up.
It makes me. I saw a tweet or something from RTD implying that there is more to what's going on than it appears. It's not going to be a Martha Jones situation where they like the actress and they just recast her. Mm.
Well, you know, the doctor says that Ruby and Mundy should get married so Mundy could be Mundy Tuesday.
Yeah. Well, and he also mentions that he's going to check back in on him.
Yeah, that's right.
But so I'm really intrigued to see how it is. I watched the whole episode and even mid episode, I went to IMDb to go, okay, is that her? And I was like, she wasn't listed. And then I saw the credits and I was like, oh, yep, it definitely was.
Yeah. Well, and I noticed it in the credits and that's why I said, I thought, oh, well, this is the episode she's in. Forgetting that. Yeah. Next season, she's more of a feature.
Well, see, that's why we had the romance angle, because we're companion auditioning.
He was great in the episode. I I did like her a lot.
Wait, okay. I'm confused now. Why did there have to be a love interest for that to be an audition? I figured she could be auditioned without the love interest.
Nah, you got to have a love interest.
You got to give her emotional trauma.
Yeah.
Okay.
Otherwise, she's just a, you know. She's just a jarhead. And that's why I think I disagree with you guys. I think the romance, I mean, yes, it did ratchet up the tension. Yes, it was there to give you an additional boom impact. you know, for before the finale. But I think that lent some additional weight that she was so hard to kind of, because he turned before she did. And immediately started trying to help. And that's when she kind of was like, okay, if you're going to jump on board with this idea of, you know, doing something, I'll go along with you. Not including the, yeah, go ahead and shoot me in the arm bit. But then losing him hit you with that emotional wallop and made her stakes more personal. That, you know, very much in the vein of, you don't know what you've got until it's gone. Because I think if he had just gotten zapped and they didn't have that romantic interest, it would have just been another war casualty. And I don't think that would have,
well,
you know, would have been, oh, sorry, you lost a.
Yeah, I don't think you needed the romance connection. You still could have had him come out looking for her, thinking that she was being threatened and shooting Ruby. And it's because you needed him there in order to be the one to do that, because that had to further the plot that way. And then right. You still could have had him realize that, oh, you know, it was a mistake and now I've got to help her. And so then he is running interference with the ambulance, trying to make sure it doesn't, you know, off her. And so he's just running interference at that time. And so it did, again, it didn't, you didn't, to me, you didn't need that other than just that one extra layer of, oh, he's, you know, he died and they were in love and now they'll never get, you know, they'll never get to share that love together. If that had been more of a plot throughout, but it just seemed like it came a little too late for me. I mean, they were hinting at it when they were both at the base. And so you knew that that's where
Splice kind of talk about it.
You knew they were going that direction, but it's like then to throw him into the heat of the battle and then, you know, kill him right after she's just found out. It didn't need to be there.
I liked it. Well, I mean, I didn't like it, but.
Oh, you were glad that he got shot.
No, I wasn't.
I can hear it in your voice.
Made me sad.
Did you guys pick up on the fact that they were fighting themselves earlier on in the episode than when they reveal it?
No, not until the doctor said it. I didn't even at one moment think that.
I kind of wondered it after a couple of references early on about them never really seeing the inhabitants of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of suspected, but more from, like you, Keith, you know, with the, we don't know what they look like. We think they're in the fog. They might be in the mud, blah, blah, blah. Sentient mud, really. Which I thought the doctor kind of dismissed rather easily. for all the weird stuff in the universe, sentient mud. No, that's a bridge too far. Really? Come on. I kind of suspected something may be up with that. I'm surprised I didn't glom onto it with all of the, oh yeah, they sell you this and they sell you this and they sell you this and this is what the hospital machines do and blah, blah, blah. That should have been a much bigger dun, 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 this is where we're going with it. But
did anybody feel like it could have used a little more time to kind of breathe? Or do you feel like it was the right amount of time? I kind of felt like it needed a little, but maybe just about 10 more minutes to kind of, maybe not, because it was so stressful. Maybe not. It just, I guess the reason I'm bringing that up is, and I didn't think about it until just now, but I remember we sat down and watched it on, we watched it Saturday. We sat down and watched it and it was over, you know, it happened and it was over and it was great. It was phenomenal, but it was just one of those, like, maybe it just left me wanting more because I'm missing Moffat's writing or something. I don't know, but it just felt like it needed just a little bit more. I don't know.
It was one of those stories that once it wrapped up and was over quickly.
And then maybe that's what it was. Maybe the end sort of felt rushed to me. Maybe that's what I'm trying to get to.
That I could buy, because once he stepped off the landmine, it became very info dump Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And with how it was wrapped up. And
I mean, we didn't even really get any resolution on the fact of if they were going to be still fighting this war against themselves or not.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like he just like, okay, I'm going to check back in on you later. Bye. And took off.
Oh, I thought that was kind of implied with the fact that the father had taken down the entire industrial.
Right. Yeah, I thought the same thing, because he got in there and basically inlaid a virus that kind of destroyed everything.
And that was one part of it. And I completely forgot about that aspect of it. But as I watched it, I remember thinking, oh, look, it's closing time.
Yep.
Defeat
it with love.
And I'm okay with it, but I just remember hearing all the outrage of, oh, that's not how it works. And
not I'm wondering like how those a bunch of Cybermen with love.
That makes more sense than overriding his not really being there AI, you know. That's not how AI typically works.
Maybe it does in the 53rd century.
maybe.
We've advanced that far.
if it is truly him, then yes, he could probably override whatever systems are there with love and fight it. But it felt like one of those Moffat things that people tend to dislike that I'm always okay with. Which is why I forgot about it, because I was okay with it, but I just thought about all the people who typically don't like that and complain about it.
Yeah.
I just want an AI now to go amok by literally running around going amok, 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 amok.
I was reading earlier today an article that brought up the fact that last year Doctor Who magazine's poll of the top episodes ever made, 10 of the top 10, 5 of them were Moffat. Do you think this will kick out another one and Moffat will then be 6 of the top 10?
Possible.
This might kick out one of his other ones ultimately as well, but it'll be interesting to see if they do that again. Of course, that's you know, if those 5 that are in the top 10 retain the top 10, because we've seen, you know, how 5 years can make a difference in that poll.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, as Sean pointed out, probably this and Devil's Court would probably make that list.
So yeah, that's true.
Potentially knock out one of those.
Yeah, that's true.
And who knows what's to come?
I have to agree with the sentiment that I saw somebody else post on Facebook this week that was essentially, my God, can you imagine if we'd actually gotten an RTD or Stephen Moffat penned episode for Jodie's run?
Right.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
And it just kind of brought it all back. It was like, yeah, that would have been good. Then I was sad.
Well, what's really interesting about this episode is I don't know if it's because Moffat wrote it, but everything, I mean, Space Babies was such a unique, different story, and then we had Devil's Court, and it feels like we're stepping away, this episode steps away from that fantasy thing that Moffat's going towards this season, and it almost makes it feel like it's going to be an anomaly within the season itself.
I think you're right, because I got to thinking back to, I mean, even if you got into the specials, you could kind of pick this apart too, but I, you know, with Church on Ruby Road, we had the goblins, and then we had, in Space Babies, we had the Bogeyman, and then we had the Maestro and the Harbinger in Devil's Chord. So yeah, it's like they have, and then if you go, like you say, you go even further back, you have the Toymaker, then you've got the two things at the end of the universe that we're trying to get in. You're right. This one's very much more grounded than anything else that's come before it so far this season. So I think you're right. It might end up being that anomalous entity or entry that kind of stands alone because it's mostly unlike any of the rest of the season.
I've got to think the placement is purposeful as well, because it almost placates any of those fans that are having issues with the fantasy. Yeah,
what happened to my sci-fi? Right, right.
Exactly.
What moment sold you? Or was there one when you're just watching this episode and you suddenly became convinced that this is a classic in the making?
I think it was the conversation that Ruby and the Doctor have when she's coming closer to bring him the canister, and she's moving closer, and he's telling her, you know, that you're incredibly brave, and I'll forgive you for being so stupid. And just that conversation was really, really, really well written, really well crafted. And I think it was at that point that I thought, oh, this is going to go down in the annals of great Doctor Who, just from that dialogue between the two.
I don't know if I had one until the episode was over.
I think I agree with Glenn, although the moment for me, it may have even come just a little bit earlier. It was, hurry and bring me back something heavy. And then she stops and gasps. And he's like, what are you? Oh. Because I kind of caught it right at the same time she did. Oh, this is her first Alien Horizon, you know, and it was a gorgeous one. I mean, if you're going to get an Alien Horizon, that's the one to get. Big ringed planet in the sky and purple clouds. And I mean, yes, it was gorgeous.
It felt very much like that one from the Sixth Doctor's era, just not as purple or pink.
Oh, yeah. with the sea? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think visually that was, and then he starts explaining, yeah, I'm so sorry, it's your first time, isn't it? This is your first, even though he just got done explaining, I can't continue to stand on one foot. You know, yeah. I'm balanced precariously enough as it is. I'm going to have to shift my weight. And as soon as I do, I'm a goner. Oh, by the way, take a moment and enjoy the sunrise.
Yeah. My only problem with that is it's going to be vastly contradicted when they go into the expanded media, because in the last episode, we established that they've already been traveling for about 3 months together. And you're going to tell me they either every adventure happened on Earth or every adventure happened on a spaceship or space station. It's a little bit of a nitpick, but it's a little bothersome.
TARDIS is finicky. You know,
free comic book that's already out has already contradicted that.
Oh, has it?
I don't know. I haven't read it yet, but I bet it has.
Man, that was a good episode. Like it ended, and I sat there for a minute shaking my head and then thinking to myself, I'm ready to watch this again.
I shook my head and thought, I hope none of the rest of this season is as stressful as this story was. What's crazy about that is a lot of times with an established show like this and established characters, in the back of your mind, you're always thinking, well, they can't kill the Doctor. They can't kill Ruby. They can't, you know, they're not going to end it here. That would be stupid. And I already know that they've shot more episodes, you know. So you think of those kind of things. This one was so well written and so well performed that it took my mind off of that. It took me out of that. And I genuinely felt like there was a chance that the Doctor was going to blow up. And to be able to do that to me, having those, you know, never fearing too much that the Doctor's ever really in peril. This time it really felt like he was in peril. And I'm impressed when somebody can write a story that good, ratchet up the tension that well. And because he could have easily put anybody else on that mine, and it would have made it probably nearly as stressful. But the problem you would have had then was it's not the Doctor who's at risk. It's somebody we've just met and aren't invested in yet. So that's a merit for that episode to be able to do that.
And it also makes it less believable if someone else is on that mind, because I believe that the Doctor could control his body enough to make it so he's that still.
Yeah.
If one of the random soldiers did it, I wouldn't believe they could do it for that long.
Right. They're not going to have a good song to get in the zen.
Yes, exactly. Or have that control. I mean, the dual muscular or circulatory system, and
right,
all of that jazz that we've mm-hmm. previously established that the Doctor can do. He's an alien. And the fact that they also play into that for the impact of, if I don't step off this mine, I'm going to blow up the entire planet.
Right.
Also
right.
helps ratchet up the tension as well.
Which is, as you said, Glenn, such a testament to how well written this is, because we've commented before, you can't put the Doctor in this kind of danger and have us believe it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't end on the cliffhanger with the Doctor dangling off the cliff, because we know he's going to get out of it. His name's in the title. You could put the companion on the landmine, and then it's like, oh, well, maybe there's some danger here. But for everything the both of you just said, it works here. It was a moment of, well, how are they going to get out of that? To, wow, this could be it. I even shifted into, okay, so how are we going to regenerate? Do you still get to if you plasma and blow up and you take half the planet with you? Is that still a thing? How are we going to bring Shooty back, knowing that he's got more episodes to go? I mean, I was fully like, yeah, okay, they're going to blow him up.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
just in awe. Just in awe.
Well, anything.
Apparently all Moffat needed was a little bit of time.
Yeah.
A little bit of distance.
That's right.
From the show. And that's that's, you know, sometimes that's it, as you just, I can get it, you know, because it's not just the pressures of writing, it's the pressures of show running, the pressures of the budget, the pressures of this, the pressures of the BBC, the pressures of the press tour, blah, 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 blah. And to do that for two doctors and X number of companions and however many years. Yeah. Something's got to give.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and arguably, as much as I loved Moffat's run, especially with the 11th Doctor, some of his best stories were written when he wasn't showrunner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's true.
And that's very true.
He's really good with the bottle episode too, isn't he? Because was it Heaven Sent or Hellbent?
Hellbent.
Bottle episode, essentially, and it's just really good. Anything else we guys want to talk about on this episode? Sean, what do you got up on the schedule? Oh, we know what's coming up on the schedule. More Doctor Who.
The next episode is coming up on the schedule.
You can find us at our website, travelingthevortex.com. If you get any value out of this podcast, why not consider putting some value back into it? You can do that by clicking on Patreon and support us there. You can also give us a 5-star review wherever you subscribe to this podcast. Helps us bump up in the ratings and the recommendations, and make sure you join in the conversations in our listeners forum on Facebook. Anything else to cover before we close this one? If not, until next time, I'm Glenn.
I'm Sean.
I'm Keith.
Cheers.
Good night, everybody.
Be seeing you. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to Traveling the Vortex. Doctor Who and all of its associated programs are owned and trademarked by the BBC. No infringement is intended or implied.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who podcast network.